From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Mary Crow Dog grew up poor on a Sioux reservation in South Dakota. As a teenager, she joined the budding Indian rights movement. She gave birth to her first child with the sounds of gunfire in the background during the occupation of Wounded Knee. On this edition of Fresh Air, Mary Crow Dog shares her story. Also today, Michael Penn. He's Sean Penn's brother, but he's making his own name as a singer, songwriter, and musician. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Vladimir Horowitz's last recording. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg examines the development of Black English in America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady told the Senate Banking Committee today that the price tag for the savings and loan bailout could run as much as $57 million higher than expected. Brady's new estimate would bring the total cost as high as $130 billion. Brady stressed that there are too many unknowns to allow for any single estimate of the cost of bailing out thrifts that have already failed and those that may still go under. Last year's thrift bailout legislation provided $73 billion to pay off the depositors of failed thrifts. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev says his plans for economic reform are as important as the Russian Revolution. The Soviet Parliament intends to discuss the reforms tomorrow, and a top Soviet official has announced plans for a national referendum. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
On the eve of a crucial discussion in the Soviet Parliament, Mikhail Gorbachev underlined the importance of his new economic reforms. He was speaking to the Federation of Russian Deputies. He said tonight the reforms were an attempt to get the economy to work. His deputy prime minister said early in the week that Gorbachev was interested in getting some of the measures implemented as soon as possible and might bypass the parliament and use his presidential powers. However, a call for an unprecedented national referendum was announced today. There's been no date set on the referendum, but Yuri Maslikov, a deputy prime minister, said in a news conference that if the referendum on the economic reform fails, then he said the government should retire. In Moscow, this is Deborah Amos.
New Jersey Governor Jim Florio signed legislation today giving the Garden State the toughest clean water enforcement law in the nation. Gene Dillard reports the bill was signed on the boardwalk in Asbury Park, just 2 days before the start of the Memorial Day weekend.
The landmark legislation imposes strict standards for industrial facilities and sewage plants that discharge into New Jersey waterways. It increases the top fine for water pollution from $7,500 to $250,000, and in some cases imposes jail terms on lawbreakers. The governor says the bill is intended to send a message.
To those who would pollute, let me make it very, very clear. No more excuses, no more ifs, no more buts, no more will you be able to throw away and get away.
Florio says the bill will ensure New Jersey's rivers, lakes, streams, and ocean will be protected well into the 21st century. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
A final surge of buying in the closing minutes pushed prices on the New York Stock Exchange to a new high today. It's the third record in as many days and the seventh for this year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points to close at 2,856.26. Advances led declines in active trading of 172 million shares. The closure again was 2,856.26. This is NPR. House Democrats agreed today not to delay final approval of emergency aid to Panama and Nicaragua by trying to link it with cuts in military aid to El Salvador. The move clears the way for $720 million in aid that the president has urgently requested. In giving up the effort to link the two issues, the Democrats said that they'd won an agreement from Secretary of State James Baker to continue talks on possible cuts in U.S. aid to El Salvador. Scientists at the University of Houston today report a major advance in developing new superconductors. But NPR's Richard Harris reports that there are still major problems yet to resolve.
We haven't heard much lately about the so-called high-temperature superconductors discovered 2 years ago. And one reason for this quiet is that while the new materials can carry electricity with perfect efficiency, scientists were disappointed to discover that the new materials can't carry very much electricity. And that limits their usefulness. but today's issue of the journal Nature reports a big advance on this front. Paul Chu and his colleagues at the University of Houston say they've made a wire that can carry a substantial electric current. However, there's still a lot of work yet to do. Paul Chu's wire is only 2 inches long, and there's no obvious way to manufacture longer stretches of the material efficiently. Yet it will take miles of wire to make electromagnets, power transmission lines, and other practical large-scale devices out of the new superconducting material. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
NATO defense ministers said today that they're prepared to reduce the readiness of their soldiers for a potential war in Europe. Leaders of the North Atlantic Treaty Association organization concluded a two-day meeting in Brussels today by announcing a plan to study changes in military strategy. The NATO minister said that the threat from the Soviet Union has reduced so much that it's possible to consider reductions in troop strength. NATO is under pressure to emphasize its role as a political organization rather than a military pact. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973, my guest Mary Crow Dog gave birth to her first child. She was there as part of the American Indian Movement, which was taking a stand against the way the tribal councils and the U.S. government ran the reservations. When Crow Dog tried to leave the reservation with her 2-week-old baby, she was arrested. Mary Crow Dog has written a memoir about what it's been like going from a life of poverty on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota to becoming active in the American Indian Movement and marrying one of the movement's spiritual leaders, Leonard Crow Dog. Her new book is titled Lakota Woman. Mary Crow Dog went to a Catholic missionary school, which forced Native American students to give up their native religion and language. As a teenager, she became a heavy drinker and describes her life then as one vicious circle of drinking and fighting. Her life took direction in 1971 when she joined the American Indian Movement. She's reconnected with many of the old Native ways of life and continues to live on a reservation. But when she was growing up, her mother hoped that the family would assimilate.
They foresaw that it was a white world. It would be a completely white world. And to get along in a white system, we had to be assimilated toward the white way in their thinking.
Were they very good at assimilating?
Well, my mother did real good. My mother is now a teacher, certified teacher. My mother did real good. She assimilated fine. And she is, you know, Christian. She lives that life.
So she doesn't live on the reservation?
Yes, she does.
Oh, she does?
She does.
Uh-huh.
She teaches on the reservation.
You never really knew your father. He left your mother, what, shortly after you were born? Or?
Right.
And he was mostly white, so you were considered a half-blood. What effect did that have on you when you were growing up on the reservation?
Well, it kind of hurt because I grew up in a full-blood community. And, well, it was all right when I was small because, like, when we played on a playground, you know, it was all right to. I could understand this and that, you know, the language a little. But my mother and my grandpa really didn't want me to talk Indian. And I even asked them over and over in my growing up years, talk to me in the language. And they said, no, you're better off without it. You know, because of the schooling, the education.
You met people from the American Indian Movement when you were still a teenager, and that seemed to really change you from being a wild teenager into being, a politically active person. How did you first come in contact with the American Indian Movement?
It was through the my own personal contact was through the occupation and takeover of the Department of Interior in Washington, D.C. And that was my first, experience with the movement. I had heard, of other things that they had done before that, which really turned me in a good way. It turned my mind, my whole mind around.
Well, how did it do that? I mean, what really reached you on a very personal and emotional level about the American Indian Movement?
When I was in school still, it came over the news that the American Indian Movement had taken over Gordon, Nebraska, protesting the death of Raymond Yellowthunder, who was forced to dance naked waist down at gunpoint in a Legion hall by some drunken rednecks at one night, and was later killed and stuffed into a back seat of the trunk car. And the movement came in. Besides that, they would, you know, it was just really open racism and prejudice in that town. It's a border town. And things, you know, that's what really hit home is when you see an old man get abused like that, an old man that doesn't bother anybody, you know, getting tragically murdered like that, it does hit home.
You were pregnant at the time of the siege of Wounded Knee.
Yes.
Describe what was happening around you at Wounded Knee as you delivered your baby.
Well, there was, I had two ladies with me. And three, actually. One was Annie Mae Aquash. Well, she was like my sister, my big older sister. She, you know, she always looked over me, you know, looked after me and made sure everything was fine. And there was another lady by the name of Ellen Mooskamp, who is a midwife, who is also a mother of a medicine man back home. And there was also this elderly lady. She's Potawatomi out of Kansas City, and she passed away a few years ago. But she is the one that born my son, and she was so cute because she was a elderly lady then. And when I went into labor and everything, she has this little derringer in her apron pocket, and she tells me, "Don't worry, nothing won't happen to you. I have this," you know, and she pulls out her little derringer. You know, little things like that were going on around me.
Were you afraid for your life?
No, I wasn't really thinking about my life at the time. I was willing to die for the cause, just to make a stand at Wounded Knee.
After the occupation of Wounded Knee, you married Leonard Crow Dog, who was one of the leaders of the American Indian Movement. And he was a medicine man. He had revived certain Sioux ceremonies. Your husband was imprisoned for, was it 2 years or 3 years?
2 years.
2 years, and this was after Wounded Knee. This was on charges stemming from Wounded Knee?
Yes, it was charges stemming from Wounded Knee.
When he got out of prison, you both returned to the reservation. Did you want to move back there?
Well, not really. I would have rather moved somewhere else where there wasn't so much bad memories, because when they came in on us, you know, they destroyed our children, you know, they couldn't really cope with what happened.
What do you mean when they came in on us?
Yeah, like September 5th, early one morning, they came down. There were about 250 U.S. federal marshals and FBI people coming down. And at that time, Leonard Peltier was underground, and Carter Camp was underground. These are Indian activists who were, you know, dodging the court system. And when they came in on us, they slammed our children around. They even kicked his mother in the butt, you know. They had no respect for anybody or anything. All they wanted, you know, they had Leonard out there on the ground, and, you know, M16s pointing at all of our heads, and they told us if we made a move, they'd shoot to kill. And so, "We know you have Leonard Peltier. We know you have him here." And they were already all over everywhere. They came in, there's just a little tiny river. They came down with these rubber rafts on the river. You know, so they had the whole area covered. But no Leonard Peltier was found. But that was one of, like, an example, you know, an example of the lengths they would go to.
Now, your husband, Leonard Crow Dog, has been a leader of the Indian rights movement. He's also a medicine man and has been working to revive certain uses of medicines and plants and also to revive certain Native American rituals. What are the expectations that he and others had of you as a medicine man's wife?
Well, to be there when, like for ceremonies, when somebody was in need of prayer, you know, like when he has a ceremony, depends on what kind of ceremony, you know, just to be there, supportive. And if, you know, there was any food that needed to be prepared or if the people wanted to know what kind of preparations to do for a certain ceremony, I'd you know, be the one to tell them what to do and how to prepare. It would depend on what kind of ceremony it would be.
But you're right that confidentially it can be hell on a woman to be married to such a holy one. What's hard about it?
Well, it's like a 24-hour job. You just can't, you know. Oh, well, here, I'm going to only do this from 9 to 5, and after 5 o'clock, the door shuts. And I don't care who has a problem, you know. That's too bad. They'll have to wait till 9 tomorrow morning. See, I can't do that. You know, if people have a problem and they come anytime, you know, I'm, you know, expected to go ahead and go through with whatever is needed to be done.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk about your life some more. And my guest is Mary Crow Dog, and her new memoir tells about her life as a Native American who became politicized by joining the American Indian Movement. She gave birth to her first child at Wounded Knee during the occupation. Her husband, Leonard Crow Dog, is one of the spiritual leaders of the Indian rights movement and has helped revive such rituals as the Ghost Dance and the Sun Dance. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mary Crow Dog is my guest, and she has a new memoir called Lakota Woman. Your husband is a medicine man. Can you describe what it means to be a medicine man now?
Well, now, it's just a difficult question because now a medicine man, like Leonard himself, was apprenticed since he was a child. He was gifted with his way, with his spiritual way and his healing ways. Whereas nowadays, today, you're going to see all kinds of medicine people, medicine women, medicine men. And now there is a lot of abuse going on with our Indian religion. And it's a shame. It's a shame that, you know, that people can get away with this kind of thing. And some people out there are so naive, they'll believe anything, you know. But a medicine man is real. He has to be real. He has to have the gift from the Great Spirit. Or as you would put it, the power of God.
See, you're saying that there's a lot of frauds now.
Yes, there is.
And there's no way of controlling that, I guess.
Well, it should be controlled because what we're worried about is the abuse that goes on with our religion. Our religion's going to end up getting outlawed again. And that's what we're really worried about.
During what period was your religion outlawed? And, you know, when was it...
When
was it legalized again? Or not prohibited, whatever.
It was outlawed during the massacre of Wounded Knee. They were holding a religious ghost dance when that happened. That's when it was outlawed. And was never really legalized years ago, and Leonard and a few other people revived the ghost dance in Pine Ridge and were sent to jail for it. And this is on the Pine Ridge Reservation again. So they brought the tree, the Sun Dance tree, back to Rosebud, back to Crow Dog's paradise. And from there, From there were only a few dancers. Now there's over 400 dancers. And our Sundance is the only Sundance that we don't allow white people to dance.
When you say that the Sundance was prohibited back at Wounded Knee, you don't mean the occupation of Wounded Knee.
You mean the massacre
at Wounded Knee. So is it legal now? I mean, would anyone have legal authority to prevent you from doing the Sundance now?
No. Because of the elements that are federally protected, like our eagle feathers and things, our different paraphernalia that we use. But it's getting out of hand. Even that's getting out of hand because it's like, it's like the white man again. You know, I'm not saying this to be racist or prejudiced, but the white frame of mind, the society that we live in, it's like everything we've had, it's been taken over. Our lands have been taken over. Our whole lives have been taken over. The last thing we have left is our religion. Now everybody's cornering us again, you know. They want our religion. You know, just like up in Oregon, there's 400 white people Sundancing up there. I don't think they're authorized to do it. I don't feel they're authorized to do it. I think if white people want to do something, you know, they should support the Indian people, support the land struggles, the fishing rights struggles, you know, different struggles that are going on. If they really want to humble themselves and make it good, you know, they don't need to. Even through that, they have a blessing. They don't have to take it upon their own self to do the whole ritual, you know.
Can you describe what the Sundance is?
Well, it's a 4 days. Well, it's actually 8 days. 4 days of purification, where you ready yourself, where you do your sweat lodges, your purification. You get all your things ready to dance, and the dance itself lasts 4 days, which is dancing before sunrise down to sundown all day. And there's piercing involved, you know, in different rituals. There's seven rites, there's seven rituals that take place during this time.
The piercing, would you describe that a little bit?
Well, it's the piercing itself is a blood sacrifice, that you sacrifice yourself, your flesh. When you humble yourself to the Great Spirit, you sacrifice, you want something in life, or you want something for somebody in life, something good. Maybe you're praying for somebody who's sick, and to pray to the tree, the sacred tree of life, and offer tobacco and pray and offer your flesh and humble yourself to the Great Spirit to look down upon you, your people to pity you.
Is the idea and part of this too that through suffering a certain amount of pain that you almost transcend the body, that the mind goes someplace else?
Well, it depends. It depends on how far you can go today.
You mean how extreme you can endure?
Yes, well, I think that's about all I'd like to say
right.
about that.
Let me ask you about why you wouldn't want to say more. Do you find that people misinterpret something like the Sundance?
Yes, mm-hmm. People might misinterpret it.
And you're probably afraid that...
And I don't want to really go into it.
Right, and you're probably afraid that if it's misinterpreted, then someone might try to prevent it from continuing. Like
well,
it had been prevented in the past.
Yeah, there was a movie I seen, which is two white guys during a Sundance, their own kind of Sundance. First, they shoot a golf ball down the hill. And then next thing you know, this guy's pierced with some kind of a iron hook, like a, you know, something you'd put a slab of meat on, you know, in a locker. And he was all fully naked, and he had something on his... his privates. You know, it was really something that wasn't. You didn't see him pray. You didn't see him. I mean, it was just nothing. All it was just being. All I could see was he was just being a masochist.
I think the movie's Ritual, Sacred and Profane. Is that the film you're talking about?
I know it's been out for a couple of years, yeah. And we just seen it recently.
I think I know the film you're talking about, and it makes it seem like these rites are for some kind of sadomasochistic exhilaration.
There's no feeling. I watched the whole movie. There's no feeling, no spiritual feeling at all. I didn't see him pray once. There was nothing. There was just nothing to that. That's what I mean. You know, people taking it upon themselves to do their own way. And they're going to jeopardize our Indian religion. People like that.
Now, you have four children?
Yes.
Right? And they're being brought up by you very differently than you were brought up. And I'm wondering what that makes you think about as you watch your children come of age in a family that's really returned to Native American ceremonies and spirituality and everything else.
Well, my oldest son, the one that was born in Wounded Knee, Pedro.
Yeah.
He dropped out of school. He's 17 years old. He has his own drum group called the Eagle Lake Singers. And he has his own group of young people that go around, you know, singing. And he makes his money that way. Also, he's learning the medicine way. But my other three smaller children, like they're two boys, 11, 9, and a daughter, 7, I'd like them to finish their school. But always keeping track. You see, I let them expose themselves to the TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think there's anybody that doesn't watch TV nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And I let them, you know, open their minds and they could see what's going on in the white world. I let them see what's going on in South Africa, what's going on in Central and South America, all over the world. And so I expose them to things like that, but also I take them to ceremonies whenever I go to participate in the ceremonies and put their interest in the ceremonies and to always have that spirituality and their culture and traditions, but also to educate themselves and have, the best of two worlds.
Mm-hmm. Would you like for them to live on the reservation after they've grown up, or do you just figure whatever they want to do is fine? Or
I'd like them to be close to home and marry in our own tribe.
Uh-huh.
Because there's really nothing out there. Now that I've lived out of the reservation, there's really nothing in the city that I could see that would benefit my children.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Crow Dog's new memoir is titled Lakota Woman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Women's Health, with two founding members of the collective that published the groundbreaking book, Our Bodies Ourselves. The collective is celebrating its 20th anniversary. And we meet Billy Avery, the director of the National Black Women's Health Project. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the album we're listening to now, the final recording by the late Vladimir Horowitz. Also, we talk with singer, songwriter, and musician Michael Penn. He's Sean's older brother. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers the direction of Black English in America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady was on Capitol Hill today, where he said the bill for rescuing failed savings and loans may cost up to $130 billion. That's $57 billion more than estimated earlier. Brady said that there are too many unknowns to provide a single estimate of the ultimate cost of bailing out thrifts. Last year, the Bush administration projected a $73 billion bailout cost. The president's son, Neil Bush, today defended his activities as a director of Silverado Savings and Loan of Denver. The thrift failed in December of 1988, and regulators charged excessive risk and insider dealing played a part in its demise. NPR's John Itzde has more.
Regulators allege that the 34-year-old Bush improperly failed to disclose business relations with Denver developer Bill Walters, who was an investor in Bush's oil and gas company. As a Silverado director, Bush voted to approve loans to Walters, a big borrower from the thrift. Today, Bush told Illinois Congressman Frank Annunzio those votes involved no conflict of interest.
I didn't have a personal or financial interest in any of Bill Walters' businesses.
Wasn't he not a partner of yours?
He was a passive, limited partner.
Call it what you want, he was still a partner.
Bush used the same rationale to defend his failure to disclose his relations with another business partner, Kenneth Good. Regulators have attempted to penalize Bush by restricting his activities if he ever serves on the board of a thrift in the future. Bush is fighting the sanctions. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
Also on Capitol Hill, the House began working on a series of amendments today to the Clean Air Bill. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The House of Representatives is speeding through its consideration of the massive Clean Air Bill, the first attempt by Congress in 13 years to pass comprehensive legislation that would overhaul the nation's air pollution laws. Like a bill passed earlier this year by the Senate, the House bill would impose strict new standards on pollutants that cause acid rain, auto tailpipe emissions, toxic pollutants that are believed to cause cancer, and other sources of urban smog. Today, the House approved an amendment that would provide a $250 million financial aid program for any workers who lose their jobs because of the clean air legislation. It would extend unemployment compensation for an additional 6 months and provide $50 million a year in retraining assistance. The Senate's version of the clean air bill doesn't include this provision, and the White House, which opposed the measure, is expected to try to kill the jobs amendment when the bill goes to a House-Senate conference. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 4 points to close at 2,856.26, another record high. Trading was active of 172 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Vladimir Horowitz was probably the most famous concert pianist of this century. He died last November at the age of 86. A new album has just been released called Horowitz, The Last Recording. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
In the liner notes to Vladimir Horowitz's last recording, pianist Murray Pariah writes about a performer who, he says, gave himself completely through his music and who confided his deepest emotions through his playing. His tone, especially if heard live, had such a dramatic presence, a speaking quality, that you felt you were listening directly to his most private thoughts. Horowitz, however, is not a pianist I associate with deep emotions, private thoughts, or a speaking quality. I think of Horowitz as representing just the opposite, a phenomenal virtuosity whose brilliant surface reveals almost no interest in the psychology, the philosophical meaning, or the structure of the music. Pariah goes on to say that Horowitz's playing was always changing, always evolving. But this recording, made just before his death, reinforces the impression that throughout a career of more than 70 years, Horowitz hardly changed at all. He played practically everything in the same style, or two styles. Anything that didn't require drop-dead virtuoso display, he delivered with a precious, small-scale daintiness, as if Mozart composed only for musical snuffboxes. Here's what Horowitz does with the opening of Haydn's great E-flat sonata. Would you be surprised if I confess that I've never been a great fan of Vladimir Horowitz? I think the mellowing some people heard in his later years was more the result of diminishing strength, even a diminished technical capacity, rather than new and searching insights. In the piano music I love most, there's never been a piece I didn't prefer played by someone else. Still, you can't deny the Horowitz fascination, the unmistakable color of his sound, his nervy energy. What I admire most about the last recording is that Horowitz plays only works he never recorded before, including this edgy version of Chopin's famous Fantasy Impromptu. The musical curiosities are two items by Liszt. Horowitz could be an astonishing Liszt player, but here, instead of dazzling virtuoso pieces, he plays two obscure works based on themes by other composers. There's Liszt's transcription of Wagner's Liebestod, the love death from Tristan und Isolde. But Horowitz, with Liszt's help, makes Wagner sound less erotic than melodramatic and sentimental. I prefer Liszt's melancholy variations on Bach's Cantata No. 12, Weinen, Klagen, Sorgen, Zagen, weeping, wailing, sorrows, and fears.
Thank you.
Sony offers virtually no information about the music itself, not even a translation of the Bach title. The only commentary is the unqualified tribute in four languages by Murray Pariah, who also happens to record for Sony. Maybe because this album doesn't emphasize the big bravura showpieces, it seems a little dull. Elegant, but monotonous. Of course, for some listeners, just the fact that it's Horowitz will be interesting enough.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Horowitz, the last recording, on the Sony Classics label. This is Fresh Air. Michael Penn's younger brothers are the actors Sean and Christopher. The family grew up in Los Angeles. Their father, Leo, is a TV director. Michael chose a different direction. He's a rock musician. His first solo album is on RCA. The first single from the album, No Myth, was popular on college and alternative radio stations. It also hit the pop charts and got airplay on commercial rock stations. Another single from the album, This and That, is currently creeping up the charts. From the album March, here's Michael Penn on vocals and guitar with his song, No Myth. Signed by RCA?
Basically, what happened was I had been in a band for years in Los Angeles, and that band had broken up, and I was really sort of disillusioned and cynical about the whole process of getting a deal with a major label and everything. And I kind of buried myself at a home studio and wrote a batch of new songs, and these were just four-track demos, and I gave the tape to my manager, and for the first time, I had no real sort of hope for it. I really just didn't care. I just sort of gave the tape and sort of said, here's some new stuff. I'm going back in and work on some more stuff. And a couple of weeks later, we got a phone call, so it was a real surprise.
You're what, about 30 years old?
Yeah.
So were you, before this album came out, thinking of giving up on a music career, or giving up on having somebody else put out your records? Like, what was your next step if this didn't happen?
Just, I didn't really think of it in those terms. I mean, I sort of felt like I'd still be doing this for my own pleasure, even if, you know, I never got signed to a major label. I mean, I had friends who had put out independent records, and I had put out an independent record previously with a band, and so there were always outlets for music, and so I didn't feel like I would ever stop doing that. It's just a matter of whether I was going to be spending my days doing, you know, some dead-end job that had nothing to do with what I was about, and that's what I had been doing to survive, but...
What kind of job?
Oh, all kinds of different things. I mean, I was working in everything from a library to working as a customer service representative at a bizarre photography company, and all kinds of strange jobs.
When you were signed by RCA, Did you tell them that you didn't want to be marketed as Sean's brother?
Well, I made it very clear to them that was not something that they could use or mention, and I was very happy to find out that they were happy that was my attitude, because they were going to suggest that to me. So, I mean, I think they were as aware of, you know, the irrelevance of that as I was, so I was happy about that.
Do you think that family connection has helped or hurt you in any way as a performer and songwriter?
No, I don't think it's helped or hurt, other than the fact that, you know, we all come from a creative family, and in that sense, I think my parents were very encouraging of their kids to pursue, their individuality.
You play guitar and program the drum machines on the record. When did you start working with a drum machine?
Well, it's not actually a drum machine. I mean, one of the things that was important to me was that on the songs that sample drum sounds were used, that it still, even though it's a very different instrument than using real drums, that it still have a certain quality and a certain feel to it that was important to me. And it's very tough to get that with a dedicated drum machine. So what I did was I sampled drum sounds and programmed the patterns on a Macintosh computer.
Is there an example from the record of a song that you think works especially well with the drum programming?
Well, I think several of them do. I mean, I think Half Harvest works really well. It's a very barren kind of drum program, and the pattern that's set up is a repetitive kind of pattern, and even when a more traditional sort of drum sound kicks into the song, it still feels really genuine to me. I don't care that you won't quit this notion of burying the carnival, but what the hell is in your potion? Dust, much less a cool millennium, but I'd much rather feel the heat of August than be sheltered and numb.
How'd you get your first guitar?
My folks got it for me. It was a little Harmony kids guitar. Half-size guitar. I still have the skeleton of it somewhere.
And what did you play on it?
As many chords as I could figure out.
Uh-huh. Did it come with a little book with dumb songs in it to learn how to play?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Was it rock songs or Red River Valley?
No, yeah, it was
what
like.
What did you muddle through?
It was like folk songs, and then I would get like sheet music that had chord charts for rock stuff, and learn various songs. And I took lessons for a while and got bored and stopped. And then the only time I ever stayed with it for any length of time was I had this teacher named Frank Javorsek, who I was taking sort of more bluegrass kind of stuff lessons from, and he was teaching me banjo and guitar and learning finger picking and stuff like that, and that was interesting to me because it was something different, and it was something that it wasn't as boring to me as learning sort of more traditional guitar playing, because it was more immediate. I could get something out of it right away, and I really liked that. And he's also the guy that turned me on to this thing called this Chamberlain, which is this instrument that is very prominent on the album. And so I'm indebted to Frank Javorsek wherever he is.
Mm-hmm. You're on what I believe is your first big national tour.
Well, we just got off the first tour, and we're about to go out again in the beginning of June.
Do you feel old or young or neither at the age of approximately 30, being on your first big national tour, or having just come off of it?
I don't particularly feel either young or old.
Mm-hmm.
I just sort of feel like, well, I'm glad that the first tour was a relatively short tour, because I've never done it before, and I didn't know, you know, I didn't know really how physically taxing it would be, and I just didn't know the ins and the outs of it. So mm-hmm. So for me it was a real learning experience, and I discovered that I can do it and not get violently ill. So
what were you afraid was going to make you ill? The stress, or
just the sort of, you know, nonstop nature of it, and the fact that, you know, you're sleeping on buses and you're driving from one city to the next, and you know, you may not get a lot of sleep, and you have to go up on stage and sort of, you know, put everything into a show, and then, you know, I had just not had that experience before.
Mm-hmm. What's been the most eye-opening aspect of touring for you?
Well, I guess the two things that struck me the most were really the fact that I didn't get bored playing the songs, that's something that I was afraid that I would, that, mm-hmm. Just playing the, you know, the same songs, which some of which are old songs to me, you know, over and over and over might get tiresome for me, but that didn't happen, so I was very glad of that. And the other thing was just the sheer joy of not having to set up my own equipment anymore.
Oh yeah. Well, you have roadies?
Yeah. Yeah, that was really nice.
So you'd have to go to the clubs and plug in.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and, absolutely.
Oversee the sound check maybe, because you couldn't trust the people at the club?
Sure. I mean, you have to do everything, and you know, you're basically doing manual labor for, you know, lifting pianos and organs onto the stage, and then you have to go out and play. And that was really great not having to do that.
So when do you go back on the road again?
June 1.
Okay, well, have a good trip.
Thanks a lot.
Michael Penn, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Michael Penn's new album is called March.
Cut me to the quick with some kind of abandon, and I'm poring over every word in my mind, and it isn't making sense. It's just coming back at random, and I already forgot what I expected to find. So maybe it's the wrong game, I shut down the replay. Maybe it's a case of heart versus heart, but I'm down for the count. There's got to be some way.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Money is in the news tonight. The savings and loan bailout in Congress will run higher than expected, and that will cause some difficulties in the federal budget negotiating on Capitol Hill. Secretary of State James Baker says the U.S. is not selling out by extending most favored nation trading status to China. And I will have a conversation by telephone with a pilot in Alaska who the other day was flying along, taking a passenger into the airport at Juneau. He was at about 2,000 feet when a duck crashed through his windshield, landed on the empty co-pilot seat. The plane is okay. The passenger's okay. The pilot is okay. The duck is in a freezer.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are dozens of languages spoken by people who live in this country, but even among those who just speak English, there are many variations. Linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts on the current state of Black English and what that suggests about our country as a whole.
Back in the late 1970s, Wisconsin Senator William Proxmire made himself the darling of the feature writers by announcing what he called the Golden Fleece Awards. The awards usually went to academics who were using federal grants to do research on what Proxmire considered preposterous waste of taxpayers' money, like studies of the sex life of bats. One target of Proxmire's ridicule was the eminent University of Pennsylvania linguist William Labov. Labov won his Golden Fleece for a project to study the speech patterns of Philadelphia dialects. Now I ask you, it would be a disaster for science if you had to justify every project on the grounds of its immediate usefulness. But Proxmire notwithstanding, research on dialects has a real social importance. Language is like the dust that collects on our shoes as we go about our daily business. We don't notice it, but a detective does. And in the same way, sociolinguists can listen to us and tell who we've been talking to. Labov has recently made this point in a provocative hypothesis about changes in the language of inner-city blacks. People used to think that the variety we call black English arose from an illiterate corruption of standard English. I suppose a lot of people still think that. But over the past 40 years, linguists have discovered that black English actually originated in what they call a Creole language. To get an idea of what a Creole is, imagine that a bunch of German, Polish, and Italian prisoners find themselves marooned on a Turkish prison island, cut off from the rest of the world. With no language in common, they piece together a kind of makeshift code called a pidgin. Most of the words are taken from their jailer's language, but the grammar is new, with bits drawn from the various languages the prisoners speak. And if they stay on the island and intermarry, their children develop the code into a genuinely new language called a Creole. The new language is like the churches you can see all over Italy that are built out of stones taken from dismantled Roman temples. The pieces are old, but the architecture's new. This was the situation of the black slaves who were brought to the American plantations speaking a variety of mutually unintelligible West African tongues. They forged a Creole that used mostly English words, but that had its own structure. The Creole probably would have remained distinct if most blacks hadn't been kept isolated on the plantations. But particularly after the Civil War, large numbers of blacks moved into the wider community. And as contact with whites increased, the Creole gradually took on more and more features of standard English until it came to seem just another English dialect. But Labov claims that in recent years this long process of convergence has reversed itself. It's true there are many more middle-class blacks speaking standard English. But in the inner city, black speech has become more dissimilar from white speech than it was a generation ago. And Labov sees this as a sign that contact between the communities is diminishing after 100 years of slow progress towards social integration. As he puts it, these linguistic results are signals of a dangerous drift in our society toward a permanent division between black and white. Labov's findings are controversial. Some linguists dispute the results, and others urge caution in interpreting them. As Stanford linguist John Rickford puts it, there's something to Labov's claim, but we want to find out what it really says about black social identity. The answers may come from some new studies by researchers at universities in several parts of the country. But whatever they tell us about the relations between black and white communities, they'll provide more evidence about the special light that language can shed on social life.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Dan Buskirk and Lisa McCullough. Congratulations on your college graduation, Lisa. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we take a look at women's health. We talk with two of the original members of the Boston Women's Health Collective, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. They're the ones that wrote Our Bodies Ourselves. And we talk with Billy Avery, founder of the National Black Women's Health Project. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.